self in this world right now. And I think that's pretty funny, actually. It can be. I mean, satirizing our world is probably one of the most ancient forms of comedy.
Yeah.
Right? Political satire has been here longer than even Shakespeare. You know, so it's an ancient thing to ridicule the jester who ridicules the king. So to bring them back down to earth, and so that we remember we're all human beings, you know. And I've been saying it a lot this week, but I'm going to say it again to your listeners. You know, the whole point of my particular play is what George Bernard Shaw called open their mouths with laughter to shove the truth in. So I think there's a really big place for comedy and humor.
And absurdism.
Yeah, absurdity. Yeah. It's around us all. So yes, hubris and absurdity. Yeah, that's. I think that was making people laugh 2,000 years ago. And now.
Well, absurdist comedy often makes us laugh at things that are actually pretty uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
What uncomfortable truth is hiding underneath the laughs in this play?
Oh, man.
There's so many.
Without giving too much away, anyways. Yeah.
No, I'd love to give the whole thing away. I think everybody would really enjoy it. It touches on our world with social media. It takes place in the near future and what might become of us, you know. It begs for our attention, because isn't that the commodity of the world? It's like money goes away and it's about the real estate in your brain.
Mm. Your consciousness.
Yeah, yeah. Your conscience. Your consciousness is you know, on the auction block here, guys. We're all fighting for your attention, so there's some value there. But we must realize how our consciousness is really the commodity we need to be precious about in our lives.
Hmm. Well, and Brenda, you've worked in television, film, Shakespeare, and now this stage production.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this give to you? What can live theater do for you and for an audience that no camera ever can?
Well, I think it was said really beautifully last night. Dan Loria, who's one of the founders of Playfest, talked about how important it is to keep new works alive. And I think that's my phone. That alarm goes through no matter what. I had it on airplane mode.
We were joking about it beforehand.
That's
now
crazy.
It's all good.
But he was saying, you know, what's going on currently in Ukraine is going to be in the future just one line in a history book until a play is made about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for us, these plays become timeless. It's ways to remember who we are, where we've been. And so for me, I did Shakespeare after being on Desperate Housewives because I needed to do something that scared me. And that's how I met John. We did a play together. We did a play that he had adapted of Titus Andronicus at the Kirk Douglas Theater. And I think as an artist, you just have to constantly put yourself in circumstances that stretch you. And this particular play, for me, really stretches me because I'm not used to doing absurdist comedy. Sure. I'm used to doing more drama
absurdist
or realism.
Drama. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Really. Exactly. So I'm really enthusiastic to see how the audience receives it because this has been really fun for me as an artist to kind of stretch myself.
And I hope everybody got the point of what she was saying. She came to do a play and got a husband. So I think that's valuable for everybody to hear.
Well, after portraying so many memorable characters, do you ever find yourself borrowing something from a role and keeping it in real life long after the show ends?
Yeah. And in the reverse, actually. A lot of my real life ends up in my work. I think it's a very kind of symbiotic relationship. Totally. You know, we were talking at lunch yesterday with some of the actors in the show, and this is what's so great about this Playfest is you get to work with people that you haven't ever met before, and you're all kind of at theater camp again.
Yeah.
And we were saying how great it is to be able to kind of show up and do something that's exciting and fun and collaborative. But the more you have an exciting life, the better artist you are.
And then the symbiotic relationship I just want to speak to is like ever since I was a kid, I think great stories and great plays, even more so than movies, but movies as well, but very much plays, helped me find my moral compass, help me find myself, help me understand critical thinking and examining a life, my own life, other people's lives. It's an empathy generator. And if empathy wasn't so valuable, people wouldn't be campaigning against it. I mean, I think empathy is a really powerful superpower. And theater is an empathy generator. So I gotta say, it's like you find your morals in Shakespeare and in plays and storytelling, not because you relate to necessarily the things that are happening in it, but you see the human condition. You see how frail people are, whether they're kings or clowns. You see all of the things they go through and you go, maybe I'm going to go through that, or maybe I can relate in my own way. And that relation to these characters, to these stories, really help you develop a backbone, I feel like, you know.
But also empathy in community is something that I think we really need right now.
Yeah.
And theater is community. I think that's the thing I love about community or theater most, is it creates a community. Mm-hmm. And no one is more important.
Yeah, strangers come into a dark room, they laugh together, they cry together, and maybe even more so than film, because you have beating hearts on stage. Something is unfolding in real time in front of you. Mm-hmm. And I think that symbiotic relationship of audience and performer and watching something play out in front of you, that's something AI is never going to touch. We're AI proof in that. And no matter when anybody says, you know, theater is dying, well, it's been dying for like 3,000 years and somehow it still keeps going. You know what I mean? So in a lot of ways, theater has been my church. It's been my therapy. It's been a lot for me. And I feel bad because sometimes I run into people who've never seen a play. And it astonishes me. But the statistics are this, guys. Only 45% of Americans have ever seen a play.
What?
Now, check this out. This one's going to hurt. Of that 45%, 70% saw that play in high school.
Wow.
And so that's why I also think, you know, we have this wonderful actor who's our narrator, actually, in my reading. And he's a high school drama teacher. And
Ben.
Ben. I'm like, that's God's work, man. He's doing amazing stuff. Because that's going to be people's first experience of theater in high school. So if you don't care much, or if you're a guy who teaches science, but they force you to do the drama class, whatever, we'll see what happens. Guys, that show at high school has to be great, because that's when you hook people into the idea of, wow, we can tell stories. We can, you don't have to be an actor. You don't have to be a writer, but you know, people in New York go to plays all the time, just like they go to dinner. It's not a special occasion. That's part of their cultural fabric
that
brings people
together. Durango really has a thriving arts community.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really impressed with how small the community is and how committed they are to
and
the arts here.
Arts-minded they
yes.
are, just
yes.
whether it's visual arts or storytelling. But I think cultures, societies are only as good as the stories they tell. And if you have more than half the population not listening to those stories, we really lose some of our unified understanding of what it is to be a human being. You know, I really believe in the value of it, you know?
Mm.
And it's often considered in this country, oh, it's undervalued or it's devalued because so many other countries give to the arts. I think it's the opposite. I think folks know how powerful this is, which is why they're scared about feeding it in this country, right? So when I write a play, when I direct a play, I do this weird thing. I pretend it's illegal. And, I pretend that my play is going to have to be performed underground, underneath a pizza parlor, and we're all going to have to gather down there and hear this stuff that is totally illegal to say. And I'm not projecting into the future. I really hope that doesn't happen. But at the end of the day, what it does is it elevates the experience to this other level, you know?
Absolutely. Well, and that's obviously, clearly you're very passionate about theater.
Yes, I think that comes across.
Clearly. I think that comes across. Brenda, you are too. You helped launch and support theater communities throughout your career, including founding the Montana Shakespeare Company. What excites you most when you see young performers sharing the stage with veteran actors and seeing that next generation come into it?
Well, just to correct you, I didn't found the Montana Shakespeare Company. I was on their board of directors, but very dear friends of mine had founded it. And one was my professor in college, Kimberly John DeLong, and he's no longer with us. But I loved having the opportunity to support smaller communities and smaller towns. It was in Helena, Montana, and very much like Durango, a thriving community that wanted good theater, and that meant a lot to me to be able to contribute to that. And part of that community also had something called Grand Street Theater, where they taught kids, and they would have theater camps. And so those of us who were performing in the plays would then go and teach the kids and engage them. And I think, you know, when you're a kid, feeling like you can be seen and accepted
and have a voice,
yeah, is so powerful. And I think theater's a great place for that. A lot of people now say that they look for theater majors because theater kids are some of the best collaborators in corporations. They know how to public speak.
Any business, yeah.
Any business. They know how to team play. Mm. They've done everything from paint the set to build the set to be on the stage to drive. You know, it's just a sense of community. Again, I go back to community. So,
yeah, any kid who's ever done, you know, theater as a study, I think they can all admit it kind of saved their life a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. because to not be able to express would have killed them maybe, you know, but they were given this opportunity to have a voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this play reportedly draws inspiration from works like Waiting for Godot.
Mm-hmm.
I once started to write an adaptation of Waiting for Godot based at the New York subway called Waiting for the O.
But that's good.
There is no O train, so they just keep waiting.
I like that. I'd like to read that play.
That's fun.
My friends and I, we were doing some adaptations for a little while. His was maybe a little better. Yeah. He did 50 Shades of Dorian Gray.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun.
I don't know if anybody wants to see that, but
it's fun to imagine. I mean, it writes itself, right?
But if Samuel Beckett were sitting in the audience opening night, what would you hope that he'd say afterwards?
Thank God I'm alive.
He's like, what am I doing here?
Durango's beautiful. I think it's all speculation, but I would hope he'd see that this was the right kind of interaction with today's world that he was having with his interaction in his time. You know, we didn't know it was World War I until after it happened. We didn't know it was World War II until after it happened. There's some that would speculate, that they'll look back at this time and go, this was a world war we were in, because there's so many conflicts around the world right now. And when he wrote Godot, it was during World War II, and between World War I and World War II. And the world felt like it was going to end. There was something about it that I think a lot of people, doomsdayers right now would kind of agree with. It feels like this is sometimes the worst of times. And he was speaking to that, and he was speaking to our place in the world and human frailty and identity and fear. These were big subjects in Godot, right? And it's not a direct adaptation of Godot, but it tackles some of those same ideas. Like, who are you? What is the world? And how am I going to be in that world? And that's the question that is eternal, right? And especially at really hot points in human history, like I think we're in one right now, where we can make a hard left or right turn into whatever the future is going to be. Mm-hmm. I think it's time to kind of laugh about it and say,
and think about it.
And think about it and have the conversations on the way home. I really hope people see my show. And the first words are not about the play that they speak, but about the issues. Mm-hmm. And this is not a soapbox preachy play. It's really not. It's just, it's showing you how absurd the world is. And then you go, wow, it is that absurd, actually. And it's made to get people to think, to talk on the way home, to have conversations with each other about it, you know? So I hope that Samuel Beckett would go, good, because that's what we're here to do.
All right. Well, I was going to end it with the question of what you hope audiences get from this. I think we've kind of answered that. Yeah. So let me ask you instead, what are you hoping to get from this? And do you see that the play will, do you think it will change a lot from the first stage reading after you get some feedback and you see that first audience reaction? And
of course, only because I look, every playwright and every actor has to learn the play they're doing. Even if you wrote it, you have to learn your play, right? Mm-hmm. So every time you hear it back, every time you work on it, you learn more about it, right? You learn more about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing, you know. I guess you asked what I hope to get out of it personally. Personally, I hope to know more about myself, actually, because I think that's what we're all here to do. Whether you're in a relationship, whether you're writing a play, whether you're acting in something, you're here to learn about yourself, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Well, love it. And definitely a lot of admiration for you there. I always tell people, as far as writing goes, there's nothing harder than playwriting. And as far as theater goes, I'm a theater nerd and a theater kid. And I mean, you have these levels of from the actor's perspective, you have to create that arc of the character and mm-hmm. figure out how you bring yourself naturally into that character with every line that you speak. And mm-hmm. then the director has a step up from that, has got to know all these characters and be able to figure out how to bring the best out of all of that. But mm-hmm. but it all starts with the playwright. It doesn't matter. You can have the best director in the world. You can have the best actors in the world. If the play is not written well, then it doesn't mean anything.
100%.
Agreed.
Every one of those lines has to be able to match and be that character. So yeah. the playwright mm-hmm. first has to know truly who those characters are.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a work of art there. And we get to really experience that up close and personal firsthand in our tiny little mountain town. It's so cool that we get to see this here and to be able to be a part of what these shows end up being shaped into. So I want to encourage everybody, go to DurangoConcerts.com, get your tickets, go to DurangoPlayFest.org, get all the details, get out there and see this show Thursday night
mm-hmm.
or Sunday matinee.
At 3 p.m. Yeah. Thank you. And please come. We want to hear your voice because after the show, we talk.
Yeah, exactly. Audience feedback.
Well, we've got more on the way. We'll be back wrapping up the show here shortly, everybody. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Durango and Durango Playfest. You're amazing. Thank you for having us.
All right. More on the way on Radio Without Rules, 107.9, 92.9, The Point.